Okay, good morning, everybody. This is the third session in this series of early Buddhism talks, of course. And today is going to be about ethics. Obviously, and what is interesting about this particular topic and what we're getting into now, so far we looked at kind of theoretical issues about what is early Buddhism, how we arrive at the idea of early Buddhism. And now we actually get into the content. This is the exciting part. What actually is early Buddhism? It's not just theory, but actually practical issues. So before I start talking about ethics as such, I thought it might be nice just to recap very briefly on what we have done so far and how what we have done so far actually relates to the various topics of the content of the Buddha's teachings. What is it? How does all this history stuff actually relate to how we decide what the teachings of the Buddha are and what ethics is, what samadhi is, what wisdom is, etc.? So this is the first thing I want to have a look at. Okay, I'll just maybe bring up the first slide. Okay. So what we have done so far in this course is basically to decide what is early Buddhism. So we started off by looking a little bit at the history of Buddhism. And when you look at the history of Buddhism, you see how it sort of starts off in a particular area, then how it expands out, how it goes into different schools, how it spreads out geographically. But also, a part of this whole thing is also not just how it spreads out and how things change over time, but also how the doctrine actually evolves over time. How the initial teachings of Buddhism slightly get transformed in each particular area where it goes to. How new ideas in Buddhism arise, how commentaries arise, and how all these various things tend to change over time. So then we looked at that history, and then we said, well, there are a number of criteria we can use in how to decide what is the earliest form of these various forms of Buddhism. So, and the kind of criteria you can use here are, you can use historical criteria, geographical criteria, archaeological criteria, but also from a Buddhist point of view, often you use like doctrinal evolution criteria. How has the doctrine evolved? And when doctrine evolves, then the later doctrine, the new evolution, always looks back to the early ones as their inspiration, right? An evolved doctrine always quotes the earlier doctrines and is an evolution from that. Whereas the early doctrine doesn't really quote anything at all, certainly not in Buddhism, perhaps outside of Buddhism, but not within Buddhism itself. And then we looked at linguistic evolution, because not only does the doctrine evolve, but the actual language in which that doctrine is couched also evolves. And then we looked at comparative studies. We looked at how once you have this evolution, that, you know, it spreads to different areas, different countries, different languages. Then once they have spread apart, you bring them back together again and you compare them and you can actually find the common source through that comparison. And what is so exciting when you look at all these different criteria, all these different ways of understanding evolution in a Buddhist sense, they all point back to the same thing. And they all point back to the same source and core teachings. And what those core teachings are that it points back to is basically this list that you have here. This is essentially then the core teachings of Buddhism. And, you know, sometimes people argue that it is maybe, it is difficult to know exactly what the early Buddhist teachings are. We cannot say anything too certain about that. But to me, I find that argument very unconvincing, because the evidence, as far as I can see, is very, very powerful, that this actually is where everything started from. This is the source. Everything else builds on this. This is like the foundation stone. Everything else comes from that. This is not a kind of absolute truth. It's not as if this is everything there is and there is nothing beyond that. There is a little bit in addition to this, but if you use this as your general idea of what early Buddhism is, then you're very, very close to the truth. You can add a few things. You can add a few things from the Vinaya, from the monastic discipline, for example, like the Patimokkha and the rules of the monastics. You can add that in there. You can perhaps add a few things from the Khuddaka Nikaya, the short Nikaya, which is the fifth group of discourses in Buddhism. There's a few things there which are early. And also you could say that there are a few things in this group here. You have the long discourses, the middle-length discourses, the connected discourses, and then the numerical discourses at the bottom. And you can say that there are some things in there which perhaps were added later on. And usually it is very obvious and very clear what actually was added. But if you have this as your basis, then really you know what early Buddhism is all about. So when we talk about ethics today, and when we talk about maybe meditation and also wisdom in the coming months, this is what we're going to be referring to. This is what we're going to go back to. And this is where we're going to get our information from. You may have noticed we talked a little bit earlier on about different languages, about Chinese and Tibetan and Sanskrit and all these other languages. So when I use here the Pali words, it doesn't mean just the Pali suttas. It means these are like the example of the suttas. Whichever language they exist in doesn't matter so much. These are just, you know, an easy access point to access the suttas because they have been translated into English, etc. Okay, so the second thing then is, why does it matter? What is the point of actually trying to find the earliest form of Buddhism? Does it really matter whether we have, you know, these suttas that were spoken by the Buddha, because the earliest Buddhism will then be the word of the Buddha? Does it really matter? Some people argue that, you know, we can use later Buddhism, forms, you know, that have evolved over time. How important is it to actually go back to the earliest form? And in my opinion, it is extremely important. It is actually precisely because this is the foundation of all other Buddhism. This is like the source, the plating, the foundation on which everything else stands. If you take away the foundation from a building, the building collapses, right? It can't stand without a foundation. And in Buddhism, it's the same thing. The reason why the rest of Buddhism, I think one scholar once said, all the rest of Buddhism that came after the Nikayas is basically just trying to work out the implications of the word of the Buddha. So if the rest of the Buddhism is trying to work out the implications of the word of the Buddha, then obviously the word of the Buddha must have a special place, right? If we haven't got the word of the Buddha, let's say the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about, he got it wrong or something, then all the rest of it becomes meaningless. It's only meaningful, the whole of Buddhism is only meaningful if the Buddha had some profound insight, had something special to say that then he shared with the rest of the world. As a teacher of Buddhism, whether you are a monastic or a layperson or whatever you are, your legitimacy as a monk, for example, or a lay teacher, whatever it is, your legitimacy comes from the Buddha. If the Buddha wasn't there, these brown robes would be meaningless, right? You can't just put on a pair, you know, some brown robes and shave your head and think that you are, you know, that something special is going to happen. It is precisely because you're part of that lineage, because the Buddha was there, and because people take him to be awakened, that this is meaningful. That's where the authority comes from. That's where the legitimacy comes from. And because of that, I have an obligation as a monastic to try to figure out what is the word of the Buddha, so I don't teach stuff which he didn't teach. It's a bit like, imagine yourself, you work for a company, and you're going to sell the products of this particular company, and then you take the money from that company, your wages or whatever, and whatever else comes from that company, and then you sell the product of a different company. Now, obviously, that's bad news, right? It's considered, it would be unethical. And it's the same thing. If I don't teach the word of the Buddha, and I teach something else, but I'm wearing these robes and pretending to be a disciple of the Buddha, it would be unethical. So there is an obligation to try to understand what the word of the Buddha is, and then to teach that. That is the whole idea of authority and legitimacy in this particular thing here. So for this reason, to get back to the source, to get back to the foundation, because we have to assume as a Buddhist that the Buddha was awakened. If the Buddha wasn't awakened, the whole thing collapses. So that is a basic assumption. If that isn't true, there is nothing here. Whereas any later Buddhism, there is always scope for doubt. Was this person awakened? Whether or not? How much wisdom did they have? It's always a degree of uncertainty. And that's why the word of the Buddha must always have a very special place in this whole thing that we call the Buddhist teachings. So here you are. This is then the word of the Buddha. So one of the interesting things, let me just move on to the next slide here. One of the things that is, of course, of great interest is if we have the word of the Buddha. What is interesting is to actually look at this word of the Buddha and look at how Buddhism often is understood in our world. Because one thing is the idea that one thing is the early teachings, and then you have the interpretation that have arisen around the world in different cultures and different places. So how do those interpretations of Buddhism that we're used to hearing compare to the early teachings? This is actually quite a fascinating thing here. And when you start looking at these things, you actually start to realize that what you find in the suttas and what is often thought of as Buddhism in the world, they're often quite different things. They often don't actually match with each other. So I thought just to start off with that before we start to talk about ethics more generally, just to have some idea that it actually matters. It actually is important to understand the early teachings because it actually gives us a perspective that we otherwise might lose. And then we can judge to some extent whether what we are learning as Buddhists, what we are hearing as traditions, whether this actually is correct or not. So let's have a look at some of these differences. The first thing here, the first point I have here is what we call the ethic of intention versus the ethic of rules. Now the idea here is that very commonly in Buddhism we have this idea of rule-based ethics, of rule-based morality. You have the five precepts, and the five precepts, that's kind of, that's it, it's sacrosanct. You have to keep the five precepts. If you keep those, then you are a good Buddhist. And it's not just the five precepts, also in the monastic lineage, it's the same kind of idea. You have the Vinaya, as we have it, with the 227 rules for monks and 311 for the bhikkhunis. In fact, there's many, many more rules than that. For those of you who have some idea of the Vinaya, there's literally thousands of rules in the monastic Vinaya. It's a very large and broad kind of rule-based thing. It's basically a legal system. And one of the things that you see is that certainly in monastic communities, very often it's a very rule-based idea of what ethic actually is. You keep the rules. And if you keep the rules strictly, then you are a good monk. That or a good nun. That is what actually matters. And sometimes you see the same thing also in for lay people. You see, if you keep the five precepts and perhaps some additional rules of morality beyond that, then that is actually what makes you a good person, keeping those things. But if you go back to the teachings of early Buddhism, what you find is actually that it actually isn't quite as simple as that. The rules there, and we'll talk more about this later on, the rules are more like guidelines. The rules are more there as kind of red lines to show you, okay, be careful. Now you might be transgressing something. You might be doing something which is dangerous. That is basically what the rules are there for. But really, the early Buddhism is an ethic of intention. It is your intention at the end of the day that matters. And you may know this from the suttas. The Buddha says that kammang chetana vadami, or something like that. In other words, kamma, action, is chetana, I say, says the Buddha. So kamma, action, is equivalent to chetana. Chetana is what matters as far as action is concerned. And that is, this is actually quite a significant difference. And we look at some very clear examples about this later on, when you can actually see that instead of just following rules, you ask yourself, why am I doing this? Where am I coming from? And you get a much greater nuance, much better understanding of ethics by doing it that way than by just following a rule-based system. So this is one of the areas where there is a big split between early Buddhism and later Buddhism. Not maybe as strong a split, depending a little bit on who is doing the practice, but it's certainly one of those splits. Okay, so the second one here is about kamma, and this is about whether kamma is, whether everything goes back to kamma, to actions in the past, or whether there are many causes for how we experience the world right now. And this is another very important thing. Very often you will hear things like, oh, that's my kamma. People, something goes wrong, and people say, oh, it must have been due to some kind of action in the past. And is that right? Is it correct to sort of attribute everything that goes wrong in life to kamma? Is it because you did something wrong in the past, that you lose your job, that you have a divorce, that your car breaks down? Is that because of kamma in the past? And The answer is that this is kind of a view that has arisen in Buddhism over time, and it arises in particular from such collections of discourses or collection of writings as the Petavattu and Vimanavattu. Vimanavattu is the basis, Vimana is like the heavenly mansion, the Peta are the departed ghosts in a sense. So these are books that talk about how you get a good result and what is the cause of that good result. And often the way it is explained in this particular story is very simplistic. It's like, you know, he did one good action. I gave a meal to an ascetic, to a Brahmin, to a Pacheka Buddha. Because of that, I got reborn in this mansion. So it's a very kind of mechanical way. You do something good and you get a good result. Or in the Petavattu, you do a bad deed. And then as a result of that bad deed, you end up in a certain place. So this whole idea that I'm moving a little bit into the next one here. But the idea is that karma is a very complex thing. And the main thing about karma is that it takes you, karma is about what gives rise to a particular rebirth in a particular place. And once you are reborn in that particular place, and there are a large number of causes that actually contribute to what you experience in a particular place. So there are many, many causes. You cannot say everything is due to karma once you have been reborn as a human being. If you are not careful, you will have a traffic accident. If you're not kind to your partner, you might get a divorce, right? If you don't do your job properly, you might lose your job. All of these things, or you may lose a job anyway. But all of these things are just things that happen in the human realm. We can talk a bit more about this later on. Then we have this idea that karma is malleable versus karma is deterministic. And this is what I was just talking about before, about the Petavattu and the Vimanavattu, is the idea that it's very deterministic. You do one thing, and then you get a result as based on that one thing. But actually, it's not like that. Reality is, it's not like you do one good act, and then that act leads to something else. That act, every act we do, is part of a network of other acts. No act stands by itself. One act cannot lead to a particular result. What that act leads to will depend on everything else you do. And this is one of those, again, very important principles of Buddhist ethics. So if you are generally a good person, and that fact that you are a generally good person means that an individual act that you do will actually be empowered because you are a generally good person. If you are a generally bad person, even if you do a single good act, it's not going to have much effect because your general attitude isn't very good. So the whole kind of network around these things is important. So individual acts always have this... They are part of a network of actions. And this whole idea of the malleability of karma, it comes back to this very famous simile that we find in the suttas, the simile of the grain of salt that we often talk about in Buddhism. And that is the simile that when you have a grain of salt, the salt stands for the bad actions that you do. And you put that grain of salt in a glass of water. It's a very basic Buddhist simile. Then that salt, that water becomes undrinkable because the amount of salt is large compared to the amount of water. The amount of bad karma is large compared to the amount of good karma. Take the same grain of salt and you put it in a large body of water like a pond or a lake or whatever. Then, of course, the amount of good karma is large compared to the amount of bad karma and it hardly tastes anything at all. So the same action, the same amount of salt, has enormously different effect depending on the rest of your conduct. These are not separate issues. So karma is malleable, it's not deterministic. It is part of this big network of things, and it's something extremely complex and difficult. And what that means, of course, is that it's not the individual act so much that matters in life. It is the overall conduct that is really important. So again, this is a difference here between later and early Buddhism. And the last point here is the idea of karma during life versus karma at death. And this is, what I have in mind here, is a thing that we often hear about as Buddhists. We're often told that the moment of death is very important. The moment you die, you have to make sure that you are peaceful, that you are at ease, that you have a sense of metta in your heart, that you remember all the good things in your life, and that would ensure a good rebirth in the future. And that is something which is not really found very much in the early Buddhism. This is largely a later accumulation. There are some slight hints in the sutta that what you are like, what happens at death is important. But generally speaking, the suttas are always about your general conduct during life, your habits, your way of living. And that is the most important aspect of how then you get reborn in the future. This is more like a commentarial idea that karma at death is important. The commentaries talk about four types of karma when you die. One of them is the death karma. One of them is what they call strong karma, if you've done a particular act which is very bad. And of course, that is there some truth that if you do something really, really bad, it's likely to come to mind in a difficult crisis situation like death. Or it is a habitual karma is the third one. And there is also a fourth one, which is... what is the fourth one? There is a fourth one as well. Anyway, right. There is some slightly obscure fourth one. So, but the point here is that that's how the commentary classified it. But from the sutta point of view, it is the habitual karma, what you do during life, in your ordinary life, that is what really matters as far as rebirth is concerned. So, there you are. These are just to give you some ideas that early Buddhism actually matters. Because when you compare the early Buddhist teachings with what we normally get to hear, you actually see that there are important differences. And this is what I'm trying to say here. So let's stop there for a little bit of meditation, and we'll get back again in about 10 minutes' time. Thank you to the. Yes, please. Killing their ant. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. There are certain kammas that are so powerful that they override the habitual kammas. And those would be examples of that. And I think there are other kammas which are, you know, maybe close to that, which also will have a very powerful effect when you die. That is true. It wasn't kind of a blanket statement that this is always true. It's just a general statement. This is generally what is right. But there are exceptions to that, precisely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Thank you for that. Okay. So let's move on to the next slide here. Okay. So we have basically the idea, what I've said so far, is basically to point out that it matters whether we deal with early Buddhism or with later Buddhism. There's a distinction between early and later Buddhism. So what we want to look at now is, what is this early Buddhism that we're talking about? So this is going to be the next part here. The first thing here, I want to talk a little bit about the scope of what we are going to look at today. And the first thing that we want to look at is the purpose of ethics. What is the point? Why even deal with ethics at all? And of course, as part of the Buddhist teachings, ethics does have a very powerful purpose. And this is one of the things we want to point out. And the more clear that is to you that these things do have a powerful purpose, the more powerful becomes your practice of ethics as well. Sometimes people say, why do you even have to talk about the purpose of ethics? It's obvious. I can feel that ethics is right. And that is a lot of truth to that. You can feel intuitively that these things are correct. I don't really need to know the purpose of these things. But the point is that if it's just an intuition, it can sometimes get lost, right? You get confused. You don't know what's going on. And then when you lose it, you have nothing to fall back upon. Sometimes it's good to make conscious our intuitions, conscious our basic understandings. And when you make them conscious, they become more powerful. And it also strengthens the actual intuition when you make things conscious. So I think it's very useful to actually reflect on these things, both use our intuition and also use our reason. And then they come together and both become more powerful in that way. And I will look a bit more about this in detail afterwards. Then the second thing here is the basis of ethics. How do we arrive at ethical rules? Okay, you know, we have the 5 precepts, you have the 8 precepts, you have the 10 precepts, you have the monastic precepts, then you have additional rules. You can expand these things into the, like you see in the Sigalovada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. This is the sutta which is sometimes called the layperson's vinaya, the layperson's discipline. And all of these rules, you know, we can sort of, after a while, you get kind of overawed with rules sometimes. What is the foundation for all these rules? Is it possible to come down to some simple idea so we can actually perhaps even derive our own rules? What is a simple way to learn how to live in a simple way so we can actually make decisions for ourselves? What is ethical and what is not ethical? This is one of the things we want to have a look at today, to see what is the foundation for this thing here. And then the last thing is the actual practice of ethics. How do we put this into a practice? How do we actually do these things? And the foundation of ethics, the basis of ethics, and the practice of ethics, they come together very, very strongly here. And we will see that in the practice of ethics, the practice is actually often quite different in the suttas from what maybe you are used to hearing about ethics otherwise. The practice of ethics is also quite different in Buddhism than it is in many other systems of thought. It is deeper, it has a different purpose, and it has a different level about it, which you don't find elsewhere. So these are the three main areas: purpose, basis, and practice. And we look at those in turn. And we will try also today to do many examples of ethics, maybe have a look at some of the ethical conundrums, some of those difficulties, how to deal with that. But one of the things I think maybe is worthwhile pointing out now is that even though it is interesting to look at all these difficult dilemmas, right, the hard questions like euthanasia is a kind of classical one, you know, and you can debate that in Buddhism. Even though these are interesting areas, and I think we may also, if we have time, we may even talk about things like drug use and these sort of things as well later on. But remember that even though these are interesting and are intellectually stimulating and they can actually lead you to a deeper understanding of what ethics is, really what is important in ethics is what we do in everyday life, right? What do we do from hour to hour? What do we do from day to day? How do we actually act? How do we speak? How do we think? How do we intend on an everyday basis? This is what ethics really is about. And this is what actually matters in life. These intellectual exercises are good occasionally, but that is not the mainstay of ethics. The mainstay of ethics is a very practical, down-to-earth way of living here and now. And it's important to keep that in mind, because otherwise it becomes a very kind of highfalutin flight of fancy and of thinking and intellectualizing, and it doesn't actually bring the benefits that ethics is supposed to bring on the path. So, having said that, let's move on to the benefits of ethics, or the purpose of ethics in Buddhism.
Okay,
I can see the next slide here. That's why I'm laughing, because the next slide has been added in here. Anyway, so the purpose of ethics. Why should we do ethics? And again, as I said before, you may think it is absolutely obvious why we should be ethical. And yet, let's think a little bit about it, simply because thinking about it can strengthen that obviousness even more. It might become even more obvious after you have thought about it a little bit. The more obvious it is, the better, right? The more powerful our practice of these things is going to be. And the first thing, the first reason why we want to be ethical is because we feel happiness. We feel good about being good people. If you have a good heart, you feel good about yourself, you feel good about life. And when we talk about happiness here, remember that happiness is sometimes kind of derided as some kind of, you know, simple thing. It's not really worthwhile striving for, you know, happiness is not kind of considered something very high or noble in sometimes in modern kind of philosophical circles or whatever. But the point here about happiness is not just kind of, you know, bliss or, you know, some kind of ecstasy or joy, or it's all of these beautiful qualities that we're talking about in Buddhism. Peace, right? Tranquility, clarity, having a clear mind, metta, compassion, all of these things, even equanimity. Equanimity is a very, very high quality in the Buddhist teachings. All of these things are part of this word when we use happiness in Buddhism. Sukha is the Pali word. And probably sukha is quite a different word from the English word happiness. It just means anything which is good, basically. Dukkha is the opposite, that which is bad. So anything which is good, any feeling, any pleasure, any sense of well-being you have, that is part of this thing we call happiness here. So why is it that ethics, being ethical, leads to this kind of happiness? What is going on here? Why does that actually happen? And one of the basic things, and this is, again, a foundational thing in the Buddha's teachings, is that when you are good, you have no remorse, you have no regret. You don't think back, I shouldn't have done this, I should have done something else. This wasn't the right thing. And that remorse is actually a freedom from suffering. It's a freedom from that lack of remorse, the freedom of suffering. And that freedom from suffering is itself a kind of happiness. You take away that suffering and you allow all the good qualities, all the goodness to shine forth, because they are no longer blocked by the remorse, blocked by the negativity and the problems in the mind. So this is one very simple reason why you become happy if you are a good person. And this is something you see throughout the suttas. This is early Buddhism for you. This is not some kind of theory anywhere else. This is found again and again and again in the early Buddha suttas. Happiness arises due to freedom from that remorse. And maybe I should say also what remorse actually means in this particular context. It doesn't necessarily always mean that you think back and you feel really bad about what you have done. Remorse is often just something which clouds the mind slightly, which makes the mind a little bit darker, a little bit more obscure, a little bit less content. Remorse is this thing which blocks the sun from shining, in a sense, in your mind, which blocks the mind from being radiant and beautiful. This is really what remorse is in this case. It's a very broad kind of idea. Take away the grayness, take away the obstacles, and the thing shines forth and becomes very, very beautiful. That is happiness, that beauty inside. And also, I think we all know from our own experience that not only is happiness about avoiding doing the bad, it's also about doing the good, right? If you do something good in life, and you do something, you know, something nice towards somebody, how do you feel afterwards? If it is a spontaneous act of goodness, you really feel like you want to do something nice, how do you feel? You feel happy afterwards, right? You feel a sense of joy. I did something good. You know in your heart that you've done a good act, and you feel happy about that. And this is something we all know directly from personal experience. And so again, we can see the direct link there between happiness and conduct, which is kind, which is good, which is generous, compassionate, filled with metta, filled with understanding. Happiness derives from that. And this is maybe one of the most powerful ways of actually understanding happiness. See it for yourself. Try these things out. Come to understand the causality which is operating there. The more you see that causality yourself, the more powerful it becomes. And then it operates, and it starts to move, it starts to shift, and your mind starts to shift as you move across like that. Now, one of the points here about happiness is not a static phenomena. It's not something you do something nice, and then you feel good for a while, and it comes back down again. Happiness or goodness is something that builds happiness over time. So you feel a little bit more happy from one good act. But then next time you build on that, so you go even higher. So it's actually a dynamic thing which is always moving forward. If you keep on being more happy, being more virtuous, being more good, and you are able to reduce any bad habits you have, any bad things, you are gradually moving upwards, right? And this is what is happening. This is the purpose here. You're actually becoming more and more and more happy, more and more peaceful, more and more compassionate, more and more kind, gradually moving up. And sometimes people find this very hard to understand. It's very difficult. I think one of the reasons why we often go around in the world seeking for sense pleasures, seeking for material things, because it is very obvious how sense pleasures and material things are going to gratify us. We can understand that. Get a new car, I'm going to be happy. I get a new relationship, it's very obvious. Get a nice dinner, it's very clear how that's going to gratify us. But actually understanding the kind of happiness which is always moving upwards, always moving towards something else, is difficult. And one of the reasons it is difficult is because we have a sense of self. A sense of self tells you the way I am is the way things will be in the future. Sense of self means having a sense of permanence. It means having a feeling, I am this way, it's not going to change. And because you can't understand the potential for change in yourself, you also cannot understand this idea of happiness always going up and always moving onwards. So the sense of self is often something that gets in the way from understanding even the basic concepts such as happiness and how happiness actually is developable, it's movable, it is something which can go forward. You are changing yourself, you're changing your psychology, you're changing your inner life. We feel sometimes that there is a block to that, but actually, because from a Buddhist point of view, the idea of a permanent self is an illusion, there is no block, and you can just keep on developing into the future. So these are some of the blockages that you can find, and this shows you the potential for happiness if you're able to look past that sense of self that we have. So the potential here is absolutely staggering. Basically, I think that's the truth of it. The potential for happiness is absolutely enormous, and most people don't realize that. So this is the first purpose of ethics, to make us more happy. I have no idea how long I've been going on now, actually, but anyway, we'll go a little bit longer. The second one is the idea of rebirth. And the idea of rebirth, of course, is a very Buddhist idea. It also belongs to certain other religions, but you don't find it in many places. You don't find the idea of rebirth. And what the idea of rebirth does, it expands the basis for ethics massively. Okay, so being ethical makes you more happy in this life. But this life is short, right? You're barely born and then you have to die. Things happen so fast. My favorite sutta, one of my favorite suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya is is supposed to have been a mythical time, a long time ago, when people lived until they were 60,000 years older. And there was no disease, you know, the diseases where you had to go to the toilet, and there was cold and, you know, cold and heat. So that was all the diseases they had in those days. And then there was a teacher who arose, and that teacher said to his disciples, "Strive on diligently, because life is short and full of suffering here." That's what he said. And it's so powerful because it puts everything in perspective, right? And now, how long do we live now? I mean, people live maybe to 80 years, maybe 90 or 100 if you're lucky. Sometimes you die even when you are, you know, middle-aged. Sometimes I think to myself, jeepers, I could die any time, basically. So the point is, life is short. But when you look at the idea of rebirth, you're expanding this vision massively. Suddenly, the actions that you do in this life, the virtue, the ethical conduct in this life has consequences far, far beyond this particular life. And that becomes a very, very powerful force in ethical conduct. And again, this brings me back to what I was saying before. Karma is not so much about how we experience things in this life. We do things good and we get something bad. Karma is about how our actions in this life transform have an effect mostly on future lives. So most of the ethics we do, most of that, the effect of that is mostly in future lives. So imagine, you know, future lives potentially go on forever, right? Long lifespans, perhaps. You stay there maybe for thousands, millions of years. And then life after life after life. And then what you're doing now affects all of that. Isn't that incredibly powerful? Isn't that kind of, oh, okay, I have to do something good. If I don't do this, I'm going to create so much misery for myself. Why on earth would you want to do that? So if you have some idea of rebirth, if you remind yourself of that, if that's something you can relate to, then use that as another force in ethics to expand, broaden out your picture and your understanding of these things. Then the last one here is awakening itself. And this, of course, is a very Buddhist thing. Now we are moving into the Buddhism in an even deeper sense. And here, the purpose of ethics is that it is the foundation stone for awakening. An awakening really is nothing but seeing things as they actually are, seeing things clearly. And ethics is needed for awakening. Why is it? Why is ethics required for awakening? And the answer to that is very simple. You just have to understand the path that leads to awakening. So awakening is seeing things as they actually are. Now, to be able to see things as they actually are, the mind has to be crystal clear. There cannot be anything in the mind which distorts your outlook. Now, the things that distort your outlook are the defilements. So you need to purify yourself. And the only way you're going to reach awakening is through having absolute purity inside. Ethics is the beginning, not only the beginning, it's the beginning and the middle and a long way into that purification process is ethics. You practice kindness and goodness because you want to reduce the defilements and the distortions of the mind. By practicing kindness, you are reducing the negative qualities, building up the good ones. You're actually purifying yourself. And one of the aspects of Buddhism that makes Buddhism here quite unique in the ethical sense is that purification here is not just the purification of speech and the purification of action by body, but also the purification of mind. So this is why the purification process is a very deep one, and it goes to a very deep level. And that is why ethics is very broad, and it takes you, most of the path actually is precisely just this, getting to be as ethical, getting your conduct to be as ethical as possible, including the mental conduct. And then, when you have succeeded in that, that includes our actions, it includes how we work with our mind, how we learn to think, it includes meditation practice, which also really is just a purification practice. That's what meditation is all about. And then, when the purity is deep enough, then you can see things as they actually are. Then the awakening becomes possible. So it's absolutely foundational for awakening. There is no awakening without ethics. Let's be clear about that. The suttas are very, very powerful about that. Ethics leads to power in meditation. Power in meditation leads to awakening. It's one and the same thing moving along. Okay, so let's do a little bit more meditation again. Sorry? Okay, please, yeah, have a theme. Yeah, this is just to help your meditation a little bit.
This is scapegoat. Feeling any remorse, any sadness or anything, just blame the lamb.
I'm not sure about that one, anyway.
That's not found in the
sutras. Not found in the sutras. Yeah, that's late Buddhism, right? Yeah. Okay, let's continue. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So, the sun is very, very warm. Yeah, I'll go back to the previous one just briefly. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So, again, the purpose of ethics, happiness, rebirth, and awakening. And when you look at that list of three things there, it's pretty powerful, isn't it? It's pretty sort of awe-inspiring. It's all really about happiness one way or another, whether it's happiness in this life or happiness in future lives, or, of course, awakening, which is the highest possible happiness. When you look at that list, it's really kind of, you know, what else do you want to do? Of course you want to be ethical. There's, everything in life is about ethics. Anything good you can possibly achieve in life comes down to ethics. Ethics is the foundation of all this. So, just even considering that, you get sort of inspired to do the right thing and to avoid doing the bad things. So, anyway, let's move on. Let's move past the scapegoat and on to the next one here, ethical theory. So, why do we need to talk about ethics? Why does the Buddha talk about ethics? This is what you certainly see in the suttas. There's a lot of suttas about ethics. Is it necessary? Can't you just say, be kind, and that be the end of the story? Why do we need a theory of these things? And one of the main reasons, as I was kind of getting at a little bit before, is this tension, if you like, but there's two aspects of why we're ethical: intuition on the one hand and reason on the other, and they work together. And a lot of the time, intuition is clear enough. You know what is right, you know what is wrong, you don't have any doubts about it, and you can act based on your inner feelings, and you know it's going in the right direction. So intuition is certainly a very important part of ethics. But there are certain people who don't have a very strong sense of intuition. They don't understand. And for them, certainly for that kind of people, it is important to actually have a different foundation for ethics. And that would then be the foundation of reason. It makes you happy. Okay, I can understand that. I may not be able to feel it, maybe, but I understand it, so I will be ethical. And there are a number of cases where intuition breaks down. Apart from those people who don't have a natural intuition, there are also a number of cases where it actually breaks down. I'm really in the hot seat right now with the sun coming in. And the areas where intuition fails, there's particularly two areas that I want to talk about. And that, one of that areas where intuition fails is in all these ethical dilemmas that we have in life. Dilemmas where it's not clear, where we cannot actually feel necessarily the right, the result of what is right and what is wrong. And we actually need to think it through to understand. And again, it comes to things like I was mentioning before, euthanasia, or perhaps abortion, or stem cell research, or and there are many other things like that as well. Maybe I'll mention some of those things later on. So these are areas where it's good to have some kind of foundation, ethical foundation, to make a clear decision. And then there's the other area. This is the lack of clarity in the mind. And sometimes, this is a very, I think, an important problem for almost all of us. Sometimes your mind is obsessed with defilements, right? With strong desires, with anger, with confusion, with pride perhaps, with arrogance, with envy, all these things that we call defilements. And when the mind is obsessed by a defilement, things tend to get turned upside down. What normally you know is wrong becomes right because of that lack of clarity. And in that sort of circumstance, it's very nice to have a rule, to have some kind of guideline which helps you to steer away from making mistakes in those particular situations. So for here again, it's very important, it's very useful to have some reasons rather than just following your intuition, because it becomes impossible to follow your intuition in those particular cases. So let us have a look, maybe have a brief look at some of these. Actually, we'll probably get back to having a look at the actual things later on. But let's think a little bit more about this idea of lack of clarity, of being in the, being in the enthralled to the defilement, so to speak. How does this actually take place? What is actually going on here? And we all know what it's like, when you are upset about something, you think that telling somebody off is the right thing to do, and then later on you regret it. Or when you have a strong desire, you have to just do this particular thing, and later on you regret it because you hurt somebody, or you hurt yourself, or whatever. These are just the realities of having defilements, that you do things which goes against your ordinary intuition, and often against your better judgment otherwise. So this is part of that. We want to get away from those difficult times. That is only part of it. Another part of it, which also is very important, is that the defilements that we have, they often run extremely deeply. And because they run so extremely deeply, normally when we act on things, we act in a way that is very rarely completely pure. There is no complete purity in these things. So because of that, although we can approach ethical standards by just using our intuition is never going to be enough unless you are fully awakened, or at least you are an Arya, somebody who has seen the truth directly. Then you might be able to get there. But for the rest of us, it's just a matter of approaching to the truth, approaching to an ethical, to the highest ethical standards. Why? Because the defilements are always there to some degree. Except maybe when you go on a meditation retreat, you have a very powerful meditation, all you feel is just bliss and pure clarity. In that circumstance, okay, maybe not. But that means that 99% of the time, there is some clouding there. So what we do then, in that case, is that we remind ourselves that there is always a problem there. And part of the path of Buddhism is to start to uncover those defilements, to understand ourselves. As we progress on the path, things that we didn't see before, defilements we didn't see before, they become clear to us. And when they become clear to us, then we can do something about them. Then, when we do something about them, ethics, our conduct, becomes even more clear to us, what is right and what is wrong. Our intuition becomes more powerful. And intuition is really only 100% trustworthy once the defilements are gone completely. Then our intuition is pure, our intuition is clear. So through all of this, it's then very useful to have these guidelines, because they guide us despite our own confusion, despite our own cloudedness of mind. So here again, intuition and reason going together. Then there is the third aspect that I have put down here, is the idea of positive ethics. Most of the time in the world, we hear about negative ethics. Negative ethics being, don't do this, don't do that. That is wrong. That shouldn't be done. And certainly I remember when I grew up, that was certainly most of the idea of ethics was precisely that, the negative side of ethics. And I think most of modern ethics is based precisely on that, in what you should not be doing. And this, again, is one area where Buddhism is quite different. It doesn't just talk about the negative aspect of ethics. It talks about the positive aspect of ethics, what we should be doing. So in other words, it's not just about don't do that. Do this. Be kind. Be compassionate. Speak gently. Speak nicely. Say something that goes to people's heart. Say the right thing. Talk about sensible things, not about all these other things. So there is a positive ethics. And this, again, is one of those beautiful contributions of Buddhism. Buddhism, you find it elsewhere, of course, as well. But where Buddhism is very powerful, and you look at the Buddhist path, what is called the gradual training, how you train towards full awakening, and it's full of this idea of positive ethics, what we should be doing, rather than just what we should not be doing. It's a very important contribution. And sometimes it is a shame, because it is so powerfully declared in the suttas, this idea of positive ethics. And yet, in Buddhist circles, we very often just hear the negative side of ethics. Don't do this. Keep the five precepts. Keep these precepts. And you're not told, actually, go out there. Do the good things. And we forget about that. But if we are going to live a complete and full ethical life, if we're going to fulfill the Buddhist path 100%, we have to also take into account the positive side of ethics. Okay, the last point here is it can be done. And this is very important, isn't it? Great. Okay, so this is one of the. You can see it. Okay, it's bad. Yeah. Doesn't matter. I'll read it out. Yeah. That is Adam Sulato's thingy. It's the sun, apparently. Yeah. No, don't worry about it. That's okay. Okay, so this is one of the suttas that was down on the reading list for this time. And this is, it's interesting that the Buddha says this, and this again shows us the power of illusion and delusion in human life. How hard it is to see beyond that delusion. And for this reason, the Buddha has to give this kind of teaching. And what he says here, he says, abandon what is unskillful, monks. It is possible to abandon what is unskillful. Or unwholesome, if you like, or bad, if you like, the akusala. If it were not possible to abandon what is unskillful, I would not say to you, abandon what is unwholesome. But because it is possible to abandon what is bad, I say to you, abandon what is unwholesome. If this abandoning of what is unskillful or bad were conducing to harm and pain, I would not say to you, abandon what is bad. But because this abandoning of what is bad is conducive to benefit and happiness, I say to you, abandon what is bad. And then the reverse, develop. And this, of course, this is the important point here. Develop what is good, monks. It is possible, and lay people, and nuns, and everyone, develop what is good. It is possible to develop what is good. If it were not possible to develop what is good, I would not say to you, develop what is good. But because it is possible to develop what is good, I say to you, develop what is good. If this development of what is good were conducive to harm and pain, I would not say to you, develop the good. But because it is conducive to benefit and happiness, I say to you, develop what is good. So, it can be done, right? This is an important principle. It's not something that is impossible to do. We can change our ways. We can change our habits. We can actually become different human beings from what we are. Okay. Yeah, so it can be done. So again, it's important to keep this in mind because it can sometimes seem very hard. And it is hard, and the reason it is hard is not because it is difficult as such, but it's hard because our habits and our ways of doing things are so ingrained, right? We have to go against our habits, our usual way of doing things. And that is what is difficult. It takes persistence. It takes perseverance. It takes that willingness to apply yourself again and again and again. That is why it's difficult, not because it is difficult as a, you know, like a, maybe a mathematical equation or anything like that. It's difficult just because it takes that effort. And that effort takes a certain degree of faith, etc. But it can be done. So don't be led astray by illusions of permanence or illusions of self. These habits of mind, oh, this is what I am like this. It cannot be changed. It can be changed. This is what the Buddha says here. You are not this. This is not what you are. Things can be different. Okay, so this is some of the reasons why ethical theory is useful, because it tends to overturn some of our ideas and to clarify things a bit for us. So let's go on to the next one. Let's have another short break before we go on to the next one. Let's see what's going on here. Yeah, let's just have another short break, and then we go on to the next one, and we... isn't it? Okay, so why ethical theory? The next one is, let's have a look at the Buddhist ethical theory, in particular the basis for this ethical theory here. So, as you probably know, and as I mentioned before, the foundation of Buddhist ethical theory is the idea of intention. Intention being the root for what deciding what is good and what is bad in Buddhism. And there's two ways of understanding this according to the suttas, according to the word of the Buddha. And one way of understanding that is to decide whether something is good or bad based on how it affects oneself and how it affects other people. And if something affects oneself and others in a good way, then it is a good thing. If it affects oneself and others in a bad way, then it is a bad thing. This is one of the criteria for deciding. And you see there's actually quite a number of places in the suttas. And the importance here is the idea of and, right? Or ourselves and others. If it is based either just for oneself or others, then it is not good enough. It has to be both. In the suttas, it always gives a triple idea: good for oneself, good for others, and lastly, good for both. Both at the same time. And to me, that is one of the wonderful ways of almost like describing a spiritual action, an act which is good, which is moral, which has kind of a spiritual content, is anything you do which is good both for yourself and others. So if you are generous, for example, if you give something to somebody else, well, obviously it is good for the other person, right? They are the beneficiary of your generosity, so it must be good for them. But it's also good for you because you feel good about being generous. If you're kind to somebody else, if you say something nice to somebody, they are obviously the beneficiary of those kind words. But so are you, because it makes you feel good to say something kind. And you can go on like that. Whenever you look at the world in that way, it's always good for both sides. Then you know that basically it is a good act. And this is usually when we look at good for oneself and good for others in this way, it refers to like the immediate daily things, right? How we deal with people in daily life. It's them and us in those particular situations. It can also refer to us and them in a kind of broader context, whereby the broader context perhaps is society at large. How do we, for example, implement laws, etc.? It can also refer to that, but that becomes a little bit more, it's a slightly different ethical framework for that, but usually it just relates to our immediate interaction with other people. So this is one way of deciding the ethics of a situation. Sometimes that may not be good enough. Sometimes it may not be clear what is the good, either for oneself or others. So sometimes you just don't know. I think you probably know what I'm talking about. So it's good to have also other guidelines on top of just the idea of what causes happiness for oneself and others. And that other main guideline that you find in the suttas is the idea of motivation. What is the driving force behind your actions? Why do you say something? Why do you do an act? This has to do with intention. Intention is what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to do something nice, or you're trying to do something, to say something, or whatever. Motivation is what drives that intention. What is it causes you to do something specific? That is motivation. Motivation and intention are slightly different. Motivation is the driving force within intention. And to be able to this is what the other way to understand whether an action is ethical or not. Is that driving force inside of you, the motivation, is it a good motivation or is it a bad motivation? And good motivation in Buddhism is traditionally down to three things. There's a motivation of non-greed, in other words, basically generosity, of non-anger or hatred, which basically is kindness towards others. And lastly, non-delusion, which essentially means wisdom. And then you have the opposites. If you have a bad motivation, it is coming from greed, coming from anger, or coming from delusion. Right? These are the three things. And the great thing about this motivation thing is usually we can look inside ourselves and we can know whether we are angry, whether we are coming from desire, whether we are coming from some sort of delusion or not. Let's talk a little bit about delusion as a motivating factor, because delusion is probably the one that is most difficult to actually understand. What do we mean by delusion in this particular case? The Pali word is moha. And delusion here is very broad. And at the basic level, it just means anything whereby the mind is not clear. It is covered by defilements in one way or another. So because we have already talked about desire and anger, it means things like being confused, for example. If you're confused, you don't know what you're doing. Being restless. The mind having, you know, sloth and torpor, perhaps. Pride, arrogance, envy. All of these things which we know are not really wholesome things that are listed again and again in the suttas as defilements. These are part of this thing we call moha or delusion. And a lot of the time we can actually see that in our minds. But delusion is also something very profound. Delusion is something that goes down to the very core of our psychology. It has to do with a sense of self and who we think we are. So it is also a very profound thing. And to completely get aside from delusion, that can only happen when you see the Dhamma for what it is, when you actually understand that there is no self inside. Only then can you act in a truly selfless manner. And that is why you will see in the suttas that the only person who is truly acting morally is actually the stream entry. It's only the stream entry, someone who was on the first stage of an awakening on the Buddhist path, someone who has seen the Dhamma, seeing the idea of non-self, seeing existence as it actually is. It's only they who can act fully morally, because only they have seen that delusion, the moha, completely and understand what it is. So in the suttas, that's why you see that the stream entry is perfect or fulfilled in virtue, according to the early suttas. Danya. It can have. It can have. But the idea of perfection of virtue is that at least the stream entry has the possibility. Sorry, okay, thank you. So the question is, doesn't the stream entry also have some aspect of delusion, and delusion only disappears completely with full awakening, with arahantship? It is true. But the point is that the stream entry has the possibility to act from non-delusion. Because once you have seen the truth, then it is possible to act from that. Of course, the stream entry will also make mistakes sometimes. Sometimes the stream entry will be caught up in defilements. And because they get caught up in defilements, they make mistakes. But they know that they have made a mistake. And because they know they have made a mistake, they will then ask for forgiveness or do whatever is required to deal with that problem that has arisen. So it is true, it's not perfect in that sense. It's perfect in the sense more that they know how to rectify something if they have gone wrong in this particular case. Okay, so these then are the two things we can use as a basis for deciding ethics in life. Motivation, you look inside of yourself, where am I coming from? It's not going to be perfect. You're never going to know your motivation 100% because it's so complicated, and there's always going to be some problems or some delusion there. But you have a good idea. You can steer yourself in the right direction. And the other one is what is good for yourself and good for others. Put those two together and you have a very good guideline for ethics in life. And based on that, you can basically make so many decisions for yourself on how to live in a right and good way. And I'll look a little bit more at that afterwards. And the next thing here I want to talk about is that these ethics, when we talk about ethics, it is not always black and white. And I think this is one of the misunderstanding of perhaps modern Buddhism is the idea that an act is either good or bad. There's this black and white idea, either you do something bad or what you do is good. But the reality is, as far as I understand the suttas, this is a little bit more controversial perhaps, but as I understand the suttas, acts are often somewhere in between. Neither are they completely pure, nor are they completely dark or completely bad. They're often somewhere in between. You know, we have mixed motivations. You know, what if you, for example, you give something, you do an act of generosity, but you do it because it's like the family tradition. We've always done this. What sort of act is that? Well, if you do it because it's a family tradition, part of the reason why you do it is because you have some attachment to your family, right? There's some sense of desire there. I want to make my parents proud. I want to keep this thing going. So there's some degree of attachment. But the act itself, the generosity, is a good one. You can compare that to an act of generosity where you just feel, oh, what a wonderful thing it is to give. I just want to do something nice. It feels so great. Please take this from me here. Please. And then you feel so happy and so blissful because you've done an act of generosity. Now that is the pure generosity, right? When you just want to give because it's such a wonderful thing to do and you know that it is a pure and beautiful act. Most of generosity for most people never rarely reaches that stage of absolute purity where you just feel, you know, utterly happy because of the act of generosity here. So most of our actions fall somewhere in between. They're not black, they're not white, they are in between there somewhere. And this, in my understanding, is again one of those areas where early Buddhism is different from later Buddhism. In later Buddhism, there's this idea that actions are always separated into either good or bad. In early Buddhism, the Buddha speaks specifically about actions that are both dark and bright, with both dark and bright results. And I understand that when he says both dark and bright, that they are a mixture. They are like grey, right? It's like a grey act with a grey result. That's how I understand that. And our purpose then is to reduce the greyness of our acts, right? To make the shades of grey lighter and lighter and lighter, moving towards brightness, moving towards the white kind of acts. This is really the purpose. So by changing your habits and changing the underlying defilements in the mind that you cannot see, you're making the shades of grey lighter and moving towards brightness. This is, again, part of this then transformation that happens through ethics. Okay, so this is just to kind of broaden the picture a little bit and to keep this thing in mind, because once you understand that, then you understand that there's always scope for improving that, improving yourself and purifying yourself. Now the second last point here is that these things I've just been talking about, the motivation and the happiness of oneself and others, these are then the basis for making any ethical decision. They're also the basis for any ethical rules that we have as Buddhists. This is where it all comes from. This is what it all comes back to. So if you talk about the five precepts, for example, they are based. These are the criteria which decides that the five precepts are right. It's not the other way around, that the five precepts come first, and then from that we derive the roots. The roots come first, and the five precepts are derived from that. The same thing with the monastic vinaya, the monastic rules, exactly the same thing. It is these foundations of ethics that come first, and the monastic rule are derived from this foundation of ethics. In other words, the Dhamma comes first, and the vinaya, the discipline, the rules, are secondary, like emanations of the Dhamma. So what we really need to do in life is to apply the Dhamma, and then the rules pretty much follow as a consequence of those basic things as laid down in the early Buddhist teachings. So what about, let's take some dilemmas in life, some of the difficult dilemmas. And of course, one of the classical dilemmas is such a thing as, I've talking about, mentioned it before, euthanasia. Let's have a look at euthanasia and how can we understand euthanasia based on these things. So the purpose here, really, for me, is to kind of enable people to make judgments for yourself as what is actually good and what is bad. How can we empower ourselves to make this judgment instead of actually always relying on rules in our conduct? So what is it about euthanasia? Well, the first criteria here, is it good for oneself or others, right? Now, if the other person wants to die, and we know that that is a fair wish, we know it's not just some kind of escapism. It's not because, just because they are depressed. It's not just because they are deluded. But it is a clear and conscious reality that some other person would like to die. And if you help, if you actually do help them to die, are you then helping them to move towards, is it good for them or is it bad for them? And, you know, sometimes people have a problem with this because it is about life and death. And one of the reasons I think people have a problem is precisely because, especially in Western society, we have this idea that life somehow is sacred, right? And this comes from ideas in Christianity and other religions, theistic religions, the idea that God has given you life. And because God has given you life, it is somehow sacred. But if you take away the idea that life comes from God, if life is just something that happens to you, going around from life to life, there's nothing inherently sacred in life as such. Life is only sacred if it's useful, if it's used to a good purpose, if it works, if it, you know, does something positive, then life is good. It's not inherently good in its own right. There's nothing in Buddhism to say that life has an inherent value to it as such. So, if that is the case, then what it means is that once life has kind of used up its purpose and you cannot use it in a good way anymore, and you feel that you have had enough, you want to make an end of all this, then there isn't really any good reason in Buddhism that ending life itself by its very nature is a wrong thing. Yeah? And it's more like, you know, if you have a terrible illness, you know, you have a cancer illness or you have something else that you can go to the hospital and you can have it cured, you can have it sorted out, then you go to hospital and you sort it out, right? This is one of the benefits of having been born in a society where these things are available. You sort things out. And in a sense, when the body falls apart at old age, it's like an illness. But at this point, the only kind of way of curing that illness is actually to end life altogether. That is, it's almost like a sense, you know, if you have hospital available to you, that's kind of a result of having been born into a society where that is the case. It's almost like good karma. In the same way, it could perhaps be argued that having things like euthanasia available in the right situation, perhaps, is good karma for a particular person. So, it is perhaps good for the other person. What about yourself? Is it good for you? Well, if you are doing something good, something to help somebody else, and you know and you feel that you're helping somebody to do something good, then presumably it is also good for you because you're actually helping another person. What about the motivation? Where are you coming from in this particular case? Well, here you have to be very careful with these things, of course, because these are areas which are, they are ethical dilemmas for a reason, precisely because it's easy to go wrong in these areas. So where are you coming from if you want to help somebody else to die? Are you coming from anger or upset because you cannot stand to see another person in suffering? Are you coming from desire because, again, you cannot stand seeing the other person like that? Or even worse, you know, you would like to have part of the inheritance or whatever, and it becomes really dodgy. So that, of course, obviously is very bad. Or are you actually coming from compassion, thinking, okay, life has really become useless for this person. There is no reason for going on with this. So what is your mind like? And this mind state, this is then how you can decide whether in a particular instance it might be right or it is wrong to go ahead with a case of euthanasia. This is like obviously voluntary euthanasia, somebody actually wanting this. So there is no, in these ethical dilemmas, there often isn't any one answer that is right or wrong. It always depends on circumstances. And only the individual can know in that situation what is right and what is wrong. It is something that you have to be very careful about because it's easy to go wrong. But sometimes, it may, I'm just saying it may be, I'm not saying it actually ever is, it's hard to know, but it may be in certain circumstances acceptable and actually be an ethical correct choice. So that is an example of difficult ethical decisions. I remember some years ago, this is a completely different one. Some years ago, I was saying to Adnan Sujato before that maybe we should introduce this just to if people feel a bit tired or whatever, because it kind of wakes people up. And I remember some years ago, it was Ajahn Brahm got a question from some disciple, and he asked Ajahn Brahm, what about sadomasochism? Is that acceptable from a Buddhist point of view? And the idea, of course, with sadomasochism is basically that some people like to be hurt, and others like to hurt others, right? You get something out of the idea of hurting somebody else. So is that bad? Is that unethical from a Buddhist point of view? And again, you can use these kind of roots of ethics to decide whether it's bad. If somebody actually, if you have two consenting people agreeing something, and they both find this enjoyable, then the first factor here is satisfied, right? It's good for oneself, it's good for somebody else. Right? The second one is the motivation. What is it that drives you to do this? And again, you know, if the motivation is one where you are not driven by anger in particular, or by some kind of misguided desire or misguided delusion, then of course, perhaps, again, it isn't such necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a difficult area, right? Because people might say that, well, if you are into these things, there's a distortion of perception there, you are looking at the things in the wrong way. But that distortion of perception is always with us to some degree. That distortion of perception is always there with any kind of sensual enjoyment. And for that reason, these are all relative to some extent. But I think there is a case to be said that even with something that is so unacceptable and so strange for most people, actually, if from a Buddhist point of view, it is not necessarily a great evil or something that is terribly bad. It is, as long as it's done in the right way, as long as it's done with without too many defilements and for an idea of the two consenting people doing it together. So anyway, so that is just a little bit of these things happen. This is what happens when you live in the West. You get these kind of questions. And when you get these kind of questions, you've got to have some sort of answer for these things. I'm not sure if... Hui Tong. Committing suicide, okay. The question is, what about committing suicide? And it depends how you commit suicide, right? There are many different ways of doing it. And I think, so people sometimes commit suicide out of despair because they feel very sad or very depressed or whatever. Huh? No. Had enough, yeah. And it depends. I mean, I think usually what is preferable, it depends on the situation. The situations are so complex, and this is part of the problem. But if you can persuade somebody that there is a way out of this depression, if you're a Buddhist and you just take that depression or negativity or whatever it is with you into the future, it's not going to be very helpful, right? You just take it with you into a future life. So if you are able to help somebody instead and bring them out of that desperate situation, it is much, much preferable rather than actually taking it with you into the future. But perhaps there are, I mean, euthanasia, voluntary euthanasia and suicide are very closely related to each other. And I think maybe there are circumstances where you feel that life is no longer, cannot really provide anything for you anymore, is not really doing anything, you can't do anything useful, where perhaps, at least, whether you call it euthanasia or suicide, I don't know, it might be acceptable. But again, you know, we have to be careful. You know, I'm not advocating suicide here at all. I'm just saying that there might be some extreme circumstances where it might be acceptable. That's all. This is the next thing we come to. Let's come to this now, because this is about the role of precepts, right? Okay. 1 minute. Is it? Yeah. What, according to that one, it's 1 minute. Yeah. Okay. So just very briefly, very, very quickly. So the idea of precepts, the precepts are derived from these rules, right? So because the precepts are derived from these rules are more foundational. So even if something goes against the precept, as long as it's in agreement with the more foundational things, which is the intention, the motivation, what is good for oneself and others, that is what is the most important thing here. That's what matters at the end of the day here. So the precepts are rough guidelines. These are like more absolute standards of ethics. Still haven't got to 10:30. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so let's call it a day, and let's meet again at 12:30 after the meal. Yeah.